'Twas on the cutter Resilient we sailed the seven seas, till it came to the Isle of Brilliant, in the middle of sea number three.
And there we thought to rest a bit, with a really good book and a biscuit. So on the shore of Brilliant Bay, we remained for a year and a day. Welcome to the Island of Brilliant,
the podcast that treasures everything brilliant in children's books.
Every day was a cloudy day for me.
Frank's got the diddles. Why are you so diddly today, Frank?
Sorry.
Right.
Forgot we were doing it.
Start. We're doing a podcast. Frank, start the podcast, please.
Nadia, how have you been? I haven't seen you around the island. What have you been up to?
Do you know what, Frank? We've been here for a while, haven't we? About a year, would you say?
A year and a day.
A year and a day. I've actually got a secret annex on the island. Whenever I want some Nadia time, that's where I go, and I'm not going to tell you where that is. How about you? You okay?
Yeah, I've just mostly been looking for Nadia, thinking.
Did you miss me?
She marooned me. I did miss you. I feel that you've got a secret store of Twix somewhere, so I've been kind of prospecting for Twix.
What makes you think that? She said, mouthful of Twix. Anyway, look, we're not going to get, as much as we try, we're not going to get sponsored by a chocolate bar. And I know that's what we've been trying for, but no one's biting, sadly. No. This is falling. Let's move on. Forget the chocolate. Let's talk about books, which is apparently why we're here, Frank.
What have you been reading, Nadia?
Well, I have been reading, Frank, a fantastic new book by Adam Stower, who I sometimes call Adam Stower, but I've been told you say Stower to rhyme with feather boa. And it's called Murray and Bun, Murray the Viking. It's part one in a series, and it's an extremely adorable comic book. You can see that Murray is a cat.
That's lovely.
Murray's a cat. And Bun is a little rabbit. Adam is such a fantastic illustrator. You might know him from... He did a book called King Koo, and he's done some picture books. He does also illustrate loads of the David Walliams books. So, you know, everyone will be familiar with his fantastic illustration style. And it's just so funny. It's about this bunny who belongs to a really rubbish wizard. And the wizard has accidentally done a spell which has made the cat flap magic. So now every time Murray wanders through the cat flap, he gets transported into another dimension.
Oh, wow, I love that.
And the rubbish wizard also accidentally turned a really nice cream bun into a rabbit. So the rabbit's called Bun, and he's got a little glacé cherry as a tail. And all Bun says is, Bun! And it's just so funny, really heavily illustrated. So I would say it's just a perfect book to... I don't want to say move on from picture books, but if you do have a child that kind of wants to explore different formats, then I would absolutely encourage you to pick up Murray and Bun. It's really, really funny. There's a really exciting kind of comics explosion happening. A lot of that's down to Jamie Smart's Bunny and Monkey series that really took off. Dog Man obviously has been around a while. I know David Fitlin put out this comic called The Phoenix, if listeners don't know The Phoenix, they should check it out. And it's just heartening to see. And obviously, as this happens, you know, the market will grow and we'll get more and more and more comic books, which is what we want. And this is one of the newer ones. So I've been enjoying it very much.
I love the sound of that. I love the Enchanted Cat Flap, which
is very funny as well.
Yeah, it's like a kind of full-on Mr. Ben. I love Mr. Ben going into the shop and changing. So doorways that change you and rubbish
doorways.
Magicians. I'm in there.
But also the drawings are all fantastic.
I love
obviously.
That format. You know, I love that.
Yeah.
It's like lots of illustration and lots of words. They're not in frames like in a comic. It's sort of bursting.
No,
out.
he's having loads of fun with the format, and like you say, he's just drawing all over the place. Some of the drawings are a full page, the little vignettes. And my favourite thing, obviously, is the comic timing is just spot on. It's really, really funny. There's a page here where little cute Bun, the bunny, is just pointing all around the pages, bouncing off the walls. It's ace. And I was reading it with an 11-year-old. Who temporarily visited the island last night, and we were both hysterical. So, you know, it's all ages, I say.
It reminds me a bit of that Grimwood book. I don't know if you know that. There's
never
Grimwood
heard of
books.
It.
No, never heard of them. They'll never catch on.
What have you been reading?
I've been reading a book, an old book that's been reissued by Susan Price. Do you know Susan Price? Have you come across Susan Price?
You always shame me by asking if I've heard of people, because the answer's always no.
I think she's not well known enough. She wrote a really fantastic series of books called The Sturcombe Handshake.
Wow, okay.
Which is set in kind of Cumbria, and they're about the Reavers, these guys who live by castle rustling in the 17th century. And they're brilliant, brilliant books. They're probably my favourite historical novels. They're just really real.
Okay.
But they've got a bit of a time travel element in them. But she's written this book called The Ghost Drum, which had just been reissued. Mm-hmm. And it's set in Russia, and it's about a shaman, a woman shaman, like a witch. Oh, it's just fantastic. It's not long, but it feels huge. And it starts with that lovely thing from Pushkin about the cat that walks round and round the tree telling a tale. It's attached to a tree by a golden chain. And it starts with this amazing story of a woman, a serf, a woman who's like, well, a slave in the Russian Empire who has a baby. And this witch comes to see her and says, I've dreamed of this baby. If you give me the baby, she'll be free.
Oh, my goodness.
So she has to decide between freedom for the child or losing her child. And this is in like the first three pages. It's just incredible, epic, full of magic, full of amazing choices. Quite dark, but really, really a wonderful read. She's a brilliant,
It sounds quite dark.
But she's brilliant on your relationships. She, in The Sturcombe Handshake, there's a relationship with the eldest child who's like 16, but his parents, who are brigands, really, they just really fuss over him, and they kind of want him to go out stealing things, but they want him to be careful as well. And it's really, she's got all that kind of real depth in the emotions. They're brilliant, brilliant books.
Is it illustrated?
No, it's not. No, okay.
It's
an older read.
In modern parlance, it's an older read.
Yeah, but it's not young adult. I mean, it might have been young adult in the day. It's not young adult. It's kind of, it's a chapter book. That's the phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
Chapter book. But it's really transporting. I mean, it feels like a proper fairy story or a folk tale. It feels like a folk tale. There you go.
Okay. Ace. And I interrupted you. What else?
I've also been reading a book that isn't out yet by Patrick Ness called Chronicles of a Lizard Nobody.
Oh, I'm dying to read this, and I'm dead jealous that you've got it. So can I have it after
you? You can have it after me. And it's, I've got a proof copy with illustrations by Tim Miller.
Ew.
But they're not coloured in, and you're invited to colour them
in
yourself.
I've seen that. I really want to colour it
in. So you can do the colouring.
Can you save it?
I'm not going to colour it in. You can do the colouring in.
Great.
And it's just very interesting because he's like someone known for writing kind of dystopian young adults.
Mm.
And he's written like a middle grade book here about a school for animals. And there's the school bully is a gigantic pelican called Pelicanassus. And this is about a sort of little weedy lizard called Zeke. It's good.
But isn't, I had a little sneaky look when you weren't looking. And isn't the idea that, so isn't Zeke a monitor lizard?
Yeah.
And don't he and his friend become hall monitors?
They're all hall monitors, yeah. And
it's nothing to do with the fact you're a monitor lizard.
Yeah, it's like we're trying to figure out if it's nominative determinism that they're fated to be monitor lizards or not, which is really sweet. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, well, I'm dying to read that, so I'll definitely have it off you afterwards, please.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Just remind me again, what was the name of the first book you mentioned?
The first one is The Ghost Drum by Susan Price.
Ghost Drum.
Which was originally published in 1987 and has just been reissued by Faber, quite rightly.
Brilliant. Well, I would like to borrow those two after you have finished.
And you can do the colouring in.
Of Patrick Ness's book, not the other book. You'd be upset. You don't like it when I colour in your other book covers, do you? You get quite grumpy. I think you should just chill out, Frank. I'm just being creative.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's what happens. If you're marooned on an island with a creative soul, you're going to wake up to your books being coloured in, all those expressive sculptures I make with leaves and
all those smiley foliage. Faces that you drew in Crime and Punishment really changed the tone.
All the speech bubbles saying, lol, and oh noes.
The little woodlouse popping up shouting, no. Put that hatchet
down. Do you not
down.
Like it? Do you not like it when I annotate all your books?
You're too rash, Kolnikov.
With a little Eric Dynamite. Oh my gosh, this is the best idea.
It is a great idea. We should do a pop-up Crime and Punishment now.
Yes. Or maybe I should do a little thing where I get you like 10 really serious books and just do Eric throughout all of them.
Eric's commentary. That'd be great.
Now look, how are you on bird watching, Frank?
I'm good at bird watching.
Are you pretty good? Because I'm rubbish.
Yeah, I know.
I'm rubbish. So like penguin, yes. Parrot, yes. All the others, unsure.
Yeah. And are you looking at what I'm looking at?
I'm looking at what you're looking at, and I am unsure. That is not a parrot.
Because when I first saw that shape in the sky...
It's not a parrot and it's not a penguin, I'll tell you that for free.
I thought, that's a kite. But it is a kite, but it's not like a red kite, it's a kite.
Right, so you're telling me that's not a bird.
No, it's a kite.
It's not a bird.
Yeah.
There's like a lump on the end of the
kite. There's an object swinging up the end of it.
Objects.
It's got the right number of legs for a bird. but it's got arms and a beret.
It's a penguin.
I mean, it's coming into land. Whatever it is, we should like make it a soft landing. Let's pile up some sand.
Okay.
Get
quick,
the sand.
Quick, come on.
Ooh, there's the Twix.
Stand back. Here comes the penguin.
Ow! Get it off me! What is it?
It's a Rob Biddulph!
I thought it was!
Oh, Rob! Oh, that's a bumpy landing.
I'm so glad you landed on Frank. Are you okay, Rob?
I'm okay. Yeah, thank you,
Dust
Frank.
Dust yourself
Thanks
down.
For the soft landing.
Oh, okay.
Frank can't speak.
A lot of writers have had an impact on me, but not in such a literal way, and not there.
Good grief. Come on, Frank. Don't be embarrassing. Oh. Buck up. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the... you're definitely not a penguin.
I'm not a penguin. And what are the chances of all the islands that I could have landed on?
You could have landed on the island of boredom, which is just over that way.
Oh, is that over that way? Is that what,
yes.
that one over there? Right.
And there's the island of ennui, which is the other way.
Right.
But you've landed on the island of brilliant.
Amazing. How lucky am I?
Yeah, very
super
brilliant.
Lucky, I'm going to say. Would you like a Dairy Milk or a Galaxy?
Where did
Galaxy?
These come from?
Doesn't matter, Frank, where they've come from. They're for our guests.
From the Nadia Hunt.
Sorry, Rob. Sit down.
That's what helped.
These are things she only brings out for best.
Sit down.
Dairy Milk and Side Clicks. It'll be doilies next.
Would you like a cup of tea, Rob?
Go on then. Yes, please. That'd be lovely. Thank you.
Frank, shut up.
This is a very well-appointed island, I must say.
Yeah. Well, would you like to sit in the island of brilliant Lazy Boy that I've just wheeled over especially for you?
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Do you want to
make yourself comfy?
Do you want milk or lemon with your tea?
Bit of milk, please.
Lemon?
Right, I'll just go off lemon. And milk the cow.
Yeah.
Rob, I'd like to apologise for Frank's demeanour. He's upset because I told him about a secret Nadia annex on the island.
Oh dear.
Which is full of
really?
Chocolate bars and Lazy Boys. He's got really upset. Anyway, it's so good to have you here, Rob. Or as I like to call you, Draw with Rob.
That is...
Which is not, it's not your full name, is it? Draw with Rob.
It might as well be my full name now. I respond to Draw with Rob. That is absolutely fun.
This is the first YouTuber we've had on the island.
I suppose I am, aren't I?
You absolutely are.
You're a triple threat. You are an author, illustrator, YouTuber. You're a man of many talents.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. YouTuber, oh my God.
I mean, that wasn't meant in a derogatory way.
I know. But you know, when you ask children what they want to be when they grow up, it's probably in the top three now, right? Or influencer, I guess. But I mean,
whenever I hear someone say they want to be a YouTuber, you then sort of have to go, well, for what? So you're on YouTube because you're an author and an illustrator, and other people might be because they're, I don't know, a footballer or... dead good at video games or whatever. There has to be something else. So I mean, I'm sure everyone listening knows who you are, but if not, I mean, you've done loads of picture books.
I think I've done about 13.
Holy moly.
Something like that.
And that's not including the Draw with Rob books.
That's not including Draw with Rob. There's another, I think I've done like 8 Draw with Rob activity books as well.
Oh my goodness.
And a few novels, 3 novels.
Well, yeah. Well, the Peanut Jones series as well, Mega Smash Hit.
Yeah, thank you.
So
yeah.
There is basically nothing you haven't done, which makes me a little bit annoyed.
Well, you know, there is plenty that I haven't done. And you know, the things that I have done, you can always do better, right? So, you know, every day's a school day.
how did you get, well, yeah, I mean, that's a good way to look at it, but how did this all begin, this adventure for you?
Well, I guess I was relatively late coming to children's books. I had a career in magazines, as I know you did as
yeah,
well, Nadia.
Yeah, we have that in common.
So yeah. My background's in magazines. My first job was on a magazine called Just 17, which was a teenage girls' magazine with pop and fashion, all that kind of thing, which was fun. I met my wife there, so, you know, it was a nice place to be. And then I went to work for the NME for 5 or 6 years. I was at the NME. I was the art director, I should say. So I was the designer of the magazines. And I was kind of like the elder statesman there because I was 30 when I was at the NME.
Whoa.
So I was like proper old. And yeah, I used to wonder, I don't know about you, but when I was working on Just 17 and the NME, I used to wonder where everybody over 30 worked. And the answer is, you know, The Guardian and The Observer, yeah, which is where I ended up next. So I had this whole career in magazines and in newspapers. And then...
And a very stellar, successful career.
Yeah.
So everything's going really well.
It's going well. But I don't know, there was just something missing. There was always something missing. Mm. When I was at The Observer, you know, the rhythms of the year are very, very similar every year. You know, you're doing, you know, fashion weeks and Christmas gift guides and... You know, the content's always different and you're working with some of the best writers and the best photographers in the world. But, you know, I was there for like 9 years in the end, The Observer. And so I felt this need to do something else kind of creative. And at that time, my children were quite young and I was reading lots of stories to them at bedtime. And I just remember thinking, oh, that looks like a nice thing to do. That looks like a nice job. And I'd done a bit of children's illustration back at uni. I'd done... quite a fair bit. I think I'd done a whole module in children's illustration.
Oh, wow.
And I just sort of thought, I'm going to have a go at writing and illustrating it. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know how to do it. I don't know if anyone really knows how to do it, but I just thought, you know, might as well have a go. If you don't try, you never know, do you? So, yeah.
Were there any particular picture books that you could remember that really made you know, ooh, I want to do that?
Yeah, the one that really, really stood out to me was The Incredible Book Eating Boy by Oliver Jeffers.
Oh,
because when I read that, I realised what an unbelievably creative medium picture books are. You know, basically, I don't know. So that book, basically what he did, he went into lots of secondhand bookshops, bought lots of... old, really old looking books, and all the illustrations are painted directly onto the books, and then he's photographed them all. And it basically, that book to me is a work of art. You know, it's a really good story as well, but underpinning it all are these amazing, amazing images. And I just thought, that looks like such, because magazines is all well and good, and it's a team game magazine, making a magazine, which is great, but sometimes for the creatives, for the art desk, it can be very frustrating because, you know, I would go into a meeting with, say, 5 covers and it gets opened up to the floor. Everyone is chipping in. Everyone's got their opinion. And so I thought, well, picture book, I get to kind of curate this thing myself. I get to, it's a bit like, I always equate making a picture book to what it must be like to make a film. Except, you know, when you're writing, as you know, Nadia, when you're writing and illustrating, you get to cast it, you get to write the scripts, you get to direct it, light it, you know, all that kind of thing, and write the dialogue, everything. Yeah. You can create this thing from scratch, from nothing, and what ends up on the bookshelf it's all kind of come from you. And I think at that time when I first decided to do it, that was something that really appealed to me. But I didn't know how hard it was to get published, and I don't know about you guys, but it took me, I think it was a good 4 years of trying before I got my first.
Really?
Oh, that's interesting.
I didn't know that.
So is Grr your first book?
No. My first one was called Blown Away.
Oh, sorry, I meant Blown Away, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, Blown Away, yeah, with the penguin flying the kite. That was my first one. And I got in the room with pretty much every publisher. I knew I was all right. I knew I could kind of do it. It was just a question of getting that first book over the line. And it took a long, long time. And actually was, you know, there's so much luck involved, right, with being published. You know, the right idea has to land on the right person's desk at the right time. And what actually happened with me, I changed my agent because I wanted just to press that reset button.
Yeah.
And I went away, and my new agent Jody at United told me to just do this kind of portfolio of children's book staples, like illustrations of children's book staples, to take out with me when I was going to meet publishers. It's so obvious, but I'd never really thought of it before. So I just drew, you know, a pirate scene, dragon scene. I drew a page full of kids characters, a page full of animals, and I just took them out with me. And there was one book, I was working up another book idea. I was working up with Random House and Puffin. I dropped in this kind of this portfolio of kids' book staples, and both of them immediately saw these little penguin characters that I'd drawn, which I can't even remember doing. You know, it was just I spent a few months just drawing all these various things, and they just went, "Oh, can you come up with a story idea for your penguins?" And then, and I think at the time I was talking to about six or seven publishers, and three or four of them all zoomed in on these penguins. So maybe penguins were in vogue at that particular time. And so then I just wrote, I had a story about kids flying a kite up on Primrose Hill, and they got blown away over the zoo and all that kind of stuff. And I just kind of tweaked the story, put penguins into that story. And then I was getting contract offers within a day.
Amazing.
It was, you know, so it was, I always say, you know, so there's so much kind of luck.
Timing.
Sort of thought.
Yeah. It's that's either a depressing thought or a liberating thought, but it's so true.
Yeah.
Unfortunately or unfortunately, that there's hard work and all the rest of it, but luck is a huge part of it.
You need to write a good story, and you need to be prepared to work hard. But lots of people have really good story ideas. You know, you just need your one to be, for some reason, for it to cut through with people at a particular time. And that's what happened with me.
And you were very patient.
Yeah.
And just, it's about hitting a chord as well, isn't it? That blown away feels like it's about something. Do you know what I mean? It's not just cute. It's very beautiful, obviously, but that thing of movement, and you know, we're always aware of the Arctic and ice and stuff like that. It feels like it's sort of trembling on the edge of something very important, but at the same time, it's really sweet and accessible. And I love that kind of floaty island thing. I mean, you could imagine, you talked about, you know, cinematic, and like that's like making a movie, but Blown Away is really genuinely cinematic. You can really imagine a DreamWorks film about that change of environment that they go through, you know, the little vegetable rafty thing, which is, you know, I actually can remember reading an article in the New Scientist about animals moving around on large rafts, you know, as a kind of explanation for the distribution of species, and thinking, oh wow, that'd be a great little movie. And you'd already done it, so I hate you.
So your books, I noticed a couple of things that I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, they're packed with jokes, which I love. And you can kind of really dawdle about on every page, and there's lots to enjoy. I mean, I'm just looking now at a page from Blown Away with the whale that's a school bus.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. You've just very subtly put the word school bus, so it wouldn't leap out at you. But if you gaze at it for a while, you see that, and there are all these little baby penguins on top of it. It's the cutest thing ever. You can tell, I think, your design background, because you use type in a very interesting way, especially in Grr. I love how you use type in Grr, because if you don't know Grr, it's about a bear who loses his Grr. And another bear literally steals the grr from like the speech bubble and sticks it up his jumper, and the grr falls out of his jumper. I thought that was really funny.
Oh, awesome.
And he creates a grr out of fonts. I just love the idea that the final twist is some fonts.
Yes.
Well, fonts have played a huge part in my life. You
of
know,
course. Yeah.
As I said, I went to art college. I went to art college thinking I was going to be initially a fine artist. I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to paint. That's what I wanted to do. Then I sort of switched over to graphic design and, as I said, did a little bit of illustration here and there. But really, it was typography that really drew me into graphic design. And I became a proper type nerd. I love fonts. I love type.
But I think you can tell. I think you can tell. You use them really well.
Completely. It's like, do you ever play cheese or font? Do you know that game? Where somebody gives you a word and you have to decide whether it's a cheese or a font.
I do know that game.
That's a brilliant game.
It's the best game. But the last page of Grr, that sort of nocturnal scene at the end of Grr, that is very cinematic. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful pages I've ever seen, I think. It's gorgeous.
Thank you. Yeah,
I mean, sorry, Frank, have you seen any of my picture books?
do you mean what? Like books that you mean, you like your childhood copies of Janet and John and Biff and Chip? Or...
Forget it. I interrupted you being very nice. It's fine.
Your books are beautiful, Nadia. I love
your... It's fine. It's not about me. This isn't about me.
Really?
Though I will piggyback on what Frank said. You've given us a sneaky peek of your next picture book.
Oh,
in terms of cinematic, my goodness. absolutely beautiful. What are you allowed to tell us about the new picture book? Because it's gorgeous.
Well, I've done a, you know, we all have to do these funny cover reveals and all that stuff now, you know. So much more to our job these days, isn't there? I spend half my time making graphics and things for social media. But yeah, I've done the cover reveal. So it's called I Follow the Fox. And yeah, I'm really proud of it. It's a slightly a departure for me. I don't know about you, but I change my illustration style slightly from book to book. I kind of get a little bit bored and I always want to do something new and something different. And yeah, for this one, I decided I wasn't going to, you know, play it for laughs quite as much as I normally do. So there's a slightly more kind of elegiac tone to the verse.
Definitely.
And I thought I wanted to reflect that with the illustrations as well. So it's a bit more painterly. There's a lot of kind of watercolory stuff in there. And yeah, lots of set piece. You know, it's interesting, Frank, what you were saying about, you know, the final scene in Gura being quite kind of cinematic. I do think like that. And I think that comes from my magazine background as well, you know, thinking about what you're going to do with the opening spread of a magazine story, you know, because there's a lot that I can take from my design career in magazines to picture books in terms of
how you
pace a picture book. I'm sure Nadia is the same with you, you know, you have a busy page.
It's not. Well, I say no because it's a thing. It's a strength I notice in your picture books that I envy.
Oh.
Your design skills are phenomenal.
Because I design the book. I don't know if I annoy my publisher, but I literally design the. I do everything in the book because I'm controlling. I think that's what the word is. But So I do the layout, the design, the font, everything, and I really do think about things like, you know, pacing. You know, so you have a busy page followed by a great big double page spread, which is quite quiet visually. And I really do think about pacing, and I also think about how my readers experience the book as well, which is, again, something that comes from my magazine background, because we were always told, you know, you can't over-deliver on a cover, you can only under-deliver on the content inside. So, you know, often in magazines, we'd always do the cover first, and you'd almost write your dream cover lines, and then it was up to everybody to kind of deliver on those cover lines. And so I think about how the reader experiences the book from the cover inwards, if you see what I mean.
I love that. I love that line.
Yeah. And with this book, yeah, there's lots of kind of cinematic scenes in there. And there's kind of like, often when I'm writing the story, I have those kind of key moments in the story, which are these big double page spread images, like in Gura, the one where the bear is doing his loud growl over the forest. You know, that was the first scene that I drew. Or in Blown Away, when they land on the jungle island, which is like a kind of Rousseau-esque kind of jungle scene, which is in that book. You know, I kind of have those down as almost markers in the story that I then have to hit with the narrative arc and that kind of thing. So yeah, I've done that. That's in Fox. I think there's I Follow the Fox. There's a few of those scenes that I was really,
so
excited about.
I mean, they're stunning. And you know, some of it brought to mind Raymond Briggs, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, the scenes where he's kind of, I mean, I'll be vague, so I'm not spoiling anything, but, you know, where our character is kind of floating over these snowy landscapes.
Yeah.
Following the fox.
Yeah.
And it did kind of make me think, in terms of how it looks, but it, the mood, it evoked something mysterious.
Well, it's got a sense of place, hasn't it? Which is often not there in picture books. Picture books are often take place in sort of picture book world, whereas that book really feels rooted in a time and a place in a really beautiful way.
That's nice.
I think you do that in general, and that's another thing that annoys me about you, Rob, because all my picture books take place against white backgrounds or flat colour, because I don't know how to do backgrounds. Have you been someone that's very good at doing kind of observational drawing? Do you keep a sketchbook? How does that work? How have you developed these irritatingly good landscape skills?
I don't know if I keep... I do keep a sketchbook on the go, but I don't like carry it with me everywhere. But I do like drawing. You know, on holiday, I'll sit and draw. I started doing quite a bit of life drawing, actually. My eldest daughter went to art college a few years ago now, 5 or 6 years ago. And before she went, we did about 6 months of life drawing classes together, just because I just wanted to get her into that observational drawing thing, which is such a big part of an art degree. And I really, really loved going back and doing that. You know, I remember my tutors at college saying, you know, the thing about drawing is you spend 90% looking and then only 10% actually putting the marks on the page. And that is so true. And I think you can take that kind of philosophy through to doing the picture book illustrations as well. And my biggest single influence, I would say, certainly in terms of children's illustration, is Richard Scarry, who I absolutely loved as a kid. And I bought all of his books for my kids as well. And what I love about his drawings is you spot something on the 10th reading you've never spotted before. Yeah. And I think that is, particularly with picture books, that is absolutely crucial. You know, you want, because children, often when you're reading bedtime stories, which we did, big bedtime stories are a huge thing in our house. Mm. It's that shared experience where the children, although they might not be able to read when they're very young, when you're first reading the books, they are reading the pictures, right? So they are spotting things in the pictures that the words aren't telling you about, you know. And that's you know, we all know the pictures tell one story and, you know, the words tell another story, and then they kind of combine to make your main story. But I love putting in lots and lots of detail, and I often put in a visual kind of B story, like in Blown Away there's the monkey who on the islands kind of stows away on the boat and then has to go back home, and in Gur there's a little hidden kind of love story between two rabbits that go on in the background. And I think that's really, really important, because, you know, I'm very much aware that the books are being read night after night after night.
That's the big difference between the books and the work that you were doing on magazines, no matter how glamorous or brilliant.
Yeah.
They're read once. Whereas really great picture book has got to be durable enough to be read and read and read and read and read. And of all things, I think picture books are subject to the most attention, because a really good picture book that you read as a child, you will read to your child, you know. So they've got to be durable across a generation. And I think that's why it's worth putting in all that work. And that's why I find every time we've interviewed a children's picture book illustrator or writer on this on the island, I've always been struck by how the depth of work that is done. And that's because they are mined. Those books are mined, you know, and that's how they become. That's how you end up saying it's mine, because you mine it for all these details. And you have that thing that you think other people haven't noticed this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Exactly. It's like, oh, I've noticed this story, but I think other people don't know that this story's in there, you know? That becomes, that's how it becomes yours. It's such a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Can we take a minute to talk about your YouTubing? Is that... Because I was thinking, like, you know, that thing of like showing kids how to draw and breaking down that mystery is such a wonderful thing. And it's like, for my generation, it was Tony Hart on Hart.
Yeah, mine too.
And then there was Art Attack.
And me.
But he would do these things where you would just do something with a piece of cutout and a crane and a bit of string. And then 5 minutes later, it'd be this incredible diorama of Stonehenge, or, you know, whatever.
Who here sent a picture?
I think it's like so that you've taken on that, you took on that mantle. Did you do that on purpose? Did you know it was going to be as big as it is? Or how many followers are there on YouTube?
And you've broken a world record, isn't that right? Like, the numbers are insane if we look at what you've achieved.
Well, the videos have been watched something like, well, over 10 million times. I don't know, millions of times. But we broke a world record in May of 2020, right in the thick of lockdown, for the largest ever online art class. I think the rigmarole of doing a live YouTube video. I mean, I was having, we were in touch with YouTube themselves, who were helping me do it all. And of course it was lockdown, so there was nobody here who could actually physically help me in person. So if my phone, which I was filming it with, went down, it was all over. But yeah, we had, I think it's something like 150. Well, we don't know exactly how many. There's about 65,000 households and schools joined in, and we think probably 150,000 people at least all drew this whale live with me. But no, it didn't. It wasn't planned. I mean, it really wasn't. I mean, I'd done most of us illustrators, don't we, Nada? We do a live draw along at our live events, which I've been doing for years and years and years, which is basically what I do in the videos, but on a stage. And I'd done some Draw with Rob videos back in 2016, just like a couple here and there, a slightly different format, but I sort of dabbled in it a bit. And then it literally was, I was watching the news. It was a Sunday night. Ali, my wife, and I were watching the news, and they said they're going to close all the schools that week. On the Monday, I recorded, I sort of thought to myself, right, I can help here. There's going to be children stuck at home looking for things to do. I can do this. I know how to do it. I know how to do the filming. I've done it before. So I filmed the first video on the Monday. I stuck it up on YouTube on the Tuesday. And honestly, I can't tell you how weird it was, because on the Wednesday, so many thousands of people had watched this video that I was on news at 10 that night.
Amazing.
It was bizarre. I think Jamie Oliver retweeted it very early on, and it just went like that. And I started to get sent, honestly, I can't, it was so weird. I just got sent thousands and thousands of drawings straight away. It was actually a really nice time, because we were all kind of supporting each other and retweeting each other's videos and all that kind of thing. And everyone was trying to do slightly different things. And it was nice to see how that the kidlit world kind of came together to do something for the children out there. And I felt very proud to be part of that community at that time. And
at the time, it must have felt crazy. Like, have you since, has the kind of emotional impact of kind of that was a really positive thing that you did for thousands and thousands of people, has that settled? Have you managed to kind of grapple with that emotion and appreciate it, or is it still a bit surreal?
It's still quite surreal. I mean, I do these for a start, every single day of my life I get sent pictures from children all around the world, which is really, really lovely, and I do my best to reply to everybody. I also get asked what pens I use every single day of my life in the videos, so there's these strange things that happen. And And of course, everyone knows my dog, who's he's not sitting behind me, but because I'm on the island. But if I was back in my studio, he would probably be sat behind me right now. And everyone knows my dog's name. You know, weird things like that. Because I don't know what I talk about in my videos. I just sit there gabbling on, and you know, it turns out all these children know all these details about me that I kind of divulge. I mean, I still do the videos, not as often now. Maybe like once a month or something, I'll do a video. But I think people see me as kind of a friend, really, because back in lockdown, when we couldn't see our real friends, I was somebody who was there with them, showing them how to do these drawings. And not just children, you know, adults too. It was really interesting, because lots of adults would say to me, you know, we haven't picked up a pencil since we were 12. Since, you know, when you're, something happens, doesn't it, to children, I think, when they're about sort of, I think, 9 or 10. Up until that point, they just sort of draw with abandon, and just for the sheer love of drawing. And then then maybe there's somebody in their class who they think is really better than them at drawing, and they convince themselves they can't draw, and then they just don't draw anymore. But actually, who's to say what's good and what's bad with drawing? So just draw because you love it. Being creative isn't really about the final product. I think it's about the process of being creative and being artistic, which is where AI falls down, because AI created art is all about the final product and not the creative process, whereas actually art is really about the creative process, I think.
That really interests me. I wondered so you are a very busy man. So there's the Peanut Jones books, which we haven't even talked about, but that's a whole trilogy of middle grade books, heavily illustrated. So you've written those. So you're a writer as well. You've got the Draw with Rob books, you've got the picture books. You're a very busy man. You do lots of events. How easy is it for you to slip back into this creative flow? Presumably you need to trick your mind into kind of, I'm playing, I'm drawing, I'm creating, and ignore the other bit, which is the art, you know, my editor wants this in by tomorrow. So like, how do you do that? Is it still possible?
It is. I mean, the fact that you write and illustrate, you're using different parts of your brain, so I would say there's usually a transition of a day or two before you kind of get in the zone and get in the flow again. But I would say the magazine background's really, really helped me in terms of deadlines. I like deadlines. I respond well to deadlines, and I like being busy. And I don't like having a day when there isn't something that I've created. So at the end of the day, I always kind of look back on my work, and I like to have made an illustration or written a verse or written a few chapters of a middle grade book. So I like I like starting with a blank page, and at the end of the day, having created something. And if I haven't done that, I get a bit antsy, you know, even on holiday, you know, I quite often write in the mornings when I'm on holiday, you know, much to my wife's kind of disgust. There's a part of the process which I can just sort of get on with. You know, Nadi, you know what it's like, you know, one day you're drawing, next day you're writing, the next day you're standing on a stage in front of hundreds of kids, you know, and so I actually really love that, and I embrace that, the fact we've got this one part of the job is sitting in my studio on my own, and then the other side is being with hundreds and hundreds of people.
The other thing I meant to ask you about, I'm jumping about all over the place, but with your picture book texts, I'm really interested that they're all in verse.
Yeah.
Well, they're...
And I find that fascinating, because I remember when I was a wet behind the ears picture book maker, people going, oh, no, don't write your picture books in verse, because then you won't be able to sell them in other countries, you won't have co-editions. And here comes Rob Biddulph.
That's absolute nonsense, isn't it?
Because, it's nonsense, clearly.
Well, I'll tell you, first, the reason I write in rhyme is because at the time that I started doing this, I was at The Observer and I was literally working with these people who are the best writers on the planet, you know. And I felt like a charlatan writing these children's books. So I kind of hid behind verse. I knew I was quite good at writing in rhyme. And I thought about the writing as like a problem to solve. Like a poem, I think, is almost like a problem to solve. You know the arc of your story, and then it's like a puzzle, you know. And it's really, really difficult puzzle, I think, writing a rhyming picture, a good rhyming picture book. You know, everyone has to be able to read it, and it has to kind of scan perfectly. And, you know, I hate it when... I don't like it when a rhyming picture book, A, doesn't quite rhyme properly, or B, there's bits you have to speed it up to kind of fit it in.
Yeah.
I kind of think it has to be perfect because they are designed to be read aloud. So I spend a lot of time talking to myself out here when I'm writing, constantly reading it aloud. But yeah, I found, I thought that I was kind of cheating the system a bit by doing the rhyme, and I was hiding behind the rhyme. So that's why I wrote in rhyme.
Okay.
And then I did meet, when I was first, you know, that 4 years where I was trying to get published, people said, oh, can you write it in, you know, straightforward prose and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, well, no, I like reading rhyming picture book. What I really like about it is that my children would sort of learn the words like they would learn lyrics to songs.
Yeah.
To songs. And they would, you know, you'd start a line and they would finish it off way before they could read. And it becomes an interactive process, the bedtime story, which... I was only ever thinking about bedtime stories, really, when I'm writing these books.
And there's a reassurance, isn't there, as well, of like, that's definitely good. Do you know what I mean? It's like when you're performing, if you get a laugh, you know you're going over, you know? So if the rhyme is good, it's good. No one can debate that. That's a good rhyme, you know?
That's true. That is very
it's
true.
It's a kind of guarantee of quality. But also it's that thing of like what we were saying before about how picture books are consumed and how they become part of a child and they stay with you. The rhyme is something that really anchors, you know. Really big eye-opening experience for me is like with my daughter once, when she was very little, she was coming back from like playgroup. We got stuck in traffic and she just opened her mouth and did the Gruffalo. And I had no idea that she had it. She did the whole thing from beginning to end. And she's not a performer, you know, she'd never done that. It was because she was bored and we were stuck in traffic. And it's like, what a gift. You know, that's now part of her software. And she's getting married in a few weeks' time. It's like, and that's still in her head, you know? And she'll have kids and it'll go straight into their heads. And it's the rhyme is the delivery system. It's the RNA, isn't it, that passes that genetic material on, you know? It's literally part of her genetic material now. Amazing.
It's really good for comedy. A rhyme as well.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of the punchline, delivering the punchline in rhyme, it really lands with children, I think. And you can sort of reverse engineer it. And that's what I do anyway. You know I need this, I need to finish on this word at this point in the story.
Yeah.
And then quite often you have to then go back and unpick loads of the story down here in order to get to the rhyme.
Get the good punchline.
That you want, good punchline. So, yeah.
So everything we've talked about, you completely threw out of the window when you did Peanut Jones.
I did.
Is what I'm realising.
I did. I don't know why.
You know, because there you are, black and white illustrations.
Those books still look like movies, though. There's a lot of cinema in there.
Oh, they do. Yeah, they're fantastically cinematic. But what I mean is, I suppose, all right, not everything then. But that, like you say, you were relying on verse to an extent. You got rid of that completely. So there's no safety net. So how did you find writing the Peanut Jones trilogy?
Well, it wasn't necessarily... I finished the picture book early, so I had like 2 or 3 months, right, where I had a bit more kind of... Usually my schedule is so back-to-back for the next, you know, for years in advance. And I thought, right, I'm going to do it. I had this idea in the back of my mind for a while about this, you know, this girl who finds a pencil, wherever she draws with this pencil becomes real. So she draws a door that leads to this illustrated world. And I had all these ideas of, you know, linking, because we visit lots of art galleries with our kids, and I thought, right, I like the idea of kids stepping into paintings and being able to, you know, make kids want to go to art galleries and kind of look at art. So I had this kind of idea in my head, and I just, you know, the books that we were reading with my girls were sort of I was growing up with them, really, with the books that we were reading, and I thought, I'm gonna have a go at writing a chapter book. I did feel quite kind of overwhelmed with the idea of writing, you know, 50,000 words. So I broke it down into bite-sized pieces and just wrote it. Had no idea really if it was any good. I thought it was all right. But then there was that it was probably the most exposed I've ever felt in my life when I pressed that send button on the email to my agent. I didn't even tell her I was doing it. Pressed the send button and then just sort of waited. I half expected her to say, yeah, just your picture books are really good. Speak with them. But no, she liked it. And then, everyone seemed to like it. There was an auction and everything.
It was an absolute hit.
Yeah.
So that change from picture books to middle grade, you're still looking for something. Is there something beyond Peanut Jones as well? Like, you left magazines because it wasn't satisfying. Well, I'm not saying that picture books weren't satisfying, but there was obviously something unused there, some colours on the palette that you weren't using. Are there other colours?
I think so. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but immediately after I finish any project, I sort of think it's rubbish. I always do. I think it's absolutely terrible. And then maybe 6 months later, or when the book comes out, you kind of reevaluate and you think, actually, that's quite good. But I always want to do something better or something different. There certainly are other things that I want to have a go at, you know, whether that's trying a bit of screenwriting or script writing, that kind of thing. I realise who I'm talking to.
Do not do that.
I realise who I'm talking to when I said that. But mate, who knows? Fundamentally, I just love making stories for children. That's what I consider myself to be, a storyteller, whether that's...
And that's a thing to be.
That is the best thing to be.
Kind of what I was hoping you were going to say is that you would like to use your talent to bring us some really good snacks, because we've been talking a long time. Snacks have not been mentioned.
Yeah, you guys...
Baking skills, any kind of confectionery work. Have you thought about
confectionery? Well, I am going to... Yeah, I have. I've bought you some snacks, actually. And I'm a bit of a crisps freak. I love crisps. Okay. But I'm talking about real crisps, not all this, black truffle and venison with cider vinegar kettle chips. I'm going like old school. So I've bought you one of those cardboard boxes with a hole in the front, and I've got I've got Fazzles. I've got Monster Munch. I've got Skips.
Yes, 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 yes.
Space Raiders. Addictive. Outer Space.
I've been hoping for Space Raiders.
French fries?
Got some French fries, salt and vinegar French fries. I've got those ones that look like little wicker baskets. Do you remember those?
Are they the ones that hurt?
Yeah, they hurt a bit when you eat them. I think crisps there needs to be a bit of pain involved.
There needs to be some pain.
Of course, my favourite, my dog's called Ringo, and I love... Do you remember Ringo's? Those crisps.
Yes. A bit oniony.
They're the best. So I got some of them, and I could go full pack lunch and give you like a United bar as well, or maybe a Wagon Wheel and a can of Quattro or something. So we're going.
Oh my
goodness. We're going back in time. So there you go.
This is dreamy. This is the best. I think this might be the 80s packed lunch. Yeah, might be the best lunch we've ever had. Yeah. This is amazing. Thank you so much.
I can remember when Ringo's counted as salad.
potato in there somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah. Do you remember that drink, Five Alive?
Yeah, Five Alive. Was amazing.
And I was like, oh yeah, this is really healthy and full of vitamins.
Yeah, Five Alive.
I used to love Five Alive. Thank you, Rob. That's very generous. Do you have, as you can see with these towers of books that surround us, we're a bit short on reading material.
Yeah.
Have you got any books that you love that you'd like to leave with us?
I was thinking, right, I should leave you a classic, right? A classic. I've read...
Yeah.
Weirdly, I've had a bit of a period, because I when I'm drawing, I can listen to audiobooks. So I've recently... sort of try to plug a few gaps in my kind of reading CV. So I've read Holes by Louis Sachar.
Amazing.
Of course, one that you might know, Frank Kentucky's Kingdom, which my kids had all read. They'd all read at school, and I'd never read. And I Capture the Castle, which I read a couple of years ago, which I absolutely loved. The Letter for the King, do you know that one?
Yeah,
by Tonka.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's so good. But the one I'm going to leave with you is a modern classic. But it's When the Sky Falls by Phil Earle.
Amazing.
It's so good. It's the best book I've read for a long, long time. It's inspired by a true story set in the Second World War, and it's kind of a reverse evacuee story. So there's this little boy called Joseph, whose dad is fighting, His mum has abandoned him, so he's living with his grandma, who can't cope with him. So she sends him off from the countryside into the city, where he goes to live with this kind of rather gruff lady called Mrs. F, who he learns is a zookeeper. And he goes with her to work at the zoo, and he meets this most of the animals have been shipped off to the countryside, apart from this one kind of big silverback gorilla called Adonis that he kind of develops this friendship with, because Joseph is very sort of angry with the world, and he sort of develops this kinship with this kind of gorilla. And then one day the air raid siren rings, and he secretly follows Mrs. F as she goes off to work, and he finds her with a rifle trained on this gorilla, because it's her job, if a bomb drops on the zoo and the animals get freed, she has to shoot the animals so that they don't kind of run amok in the city. And so the story is just so brilliant, because you sort of know at some point there's this awful dilemma that's going to appear in the story, and whether she's going to shoot the gorilla or not. I mean, I did two cries, like proper railway children sobs, you know, in the book. And there's just these amazing kind of themes of, you know, loss, guilt, loneliness, but underpinned with kind of friendship, I think. And then one other book I'm going to show you this book. It's this one here.
Yay! So,
it's called Richard Scarry's Biggest Book Ever. And I just thought you guys, being stuck on the island, you might need some really detailed illustrations to look at.
Beauty.
What I used to do with my youngest daughter was, at bedtime, we would pick things and the other had to find them, like a bit Where's Wally-like on the page.
Yeah.
So, you know, can you find the mouse in the, you know, the rainbow-coloured pencil car, that kind of thing. So I thought that might keep you
occupied. Thank you.
There you go.
I have wanted that book for a long time, so thank you very
You're welcome.
Rob. Thanks for visiting our island.
Oh,
it's been
thank
an
you
absolute pleasure. Are you going to go off on your kite now?
Yeah, I need the wind to change. Oh, look, I think it's changing. So, let's get the kite up into the sky. And thanks for having me, guys.
Bye, Rob.
See you later.
Bye. Fly safely. Fly safe.
Bye.
Bye. What a convenient wind.
Oh, Rob's a lovely man, isn't he, Frank?
Yeah,
it's
lovely
really
person.
Annoying how good he is.
I know, it's really annoying how lovely
say
he
that,
is.
Should
I think
I?
It's probably... So he's a better writer because he's a better person. Oh no!
Like, I know. I think that's
kind of holding on to being a good person.
Do you know what, Fran? I think that's the real reason behind why we're actually marooned on this island. It's all going to be revealed in the final episode. This has been
why nobody's missing us. There's no rescue mission.
Terrible limbo land. The children's book industry thriving at the loss of Frank Ochterboys and Nigel Street.
That's what's happening.
Fair enough. Yeah, look, let's distract ourselves by picking up this wildly convenient shell, which, if we put it to our ear, I believe contains the dulcet and beautiful tones of Emily Drabble of Buttrust fame.
Oh, Emily Drabble.
Hi, Nadia and Frank. It's just so lovely to think of you swinging in your hammocks with a soft breeze in your hair and a book in hand. Here are five of my favourites this month, and I will be sending them to you by hot air balloon. They should be there in a couple of days. Okay, first of all, Rewild, Can Nature Heal Our World? By Ben Martinoga and Moose Alain, published by David Ficklin. This book made me breathe out, and children need it. Without shying away from the facts that due to human activity, the world is under dire threat, this book is all about the solutions rewilding offers and why. From the extreme benefits of bringing back beavers, wolves, even mammoths, due to their places in food chains and the work they do, to rewilding the seas, to planting the right trees in the right places, it's all explained brilliantly with amusing illustrations and a particularly helpful know-it-all fungus. The end result on reading it is to fill your head with positive possibilities rather than bury your head in the sand to suppress your screams, not only focusing on everything we have to give up, but on all the things we'd gain from a wilder, less polluted world, a bit like you on the island. It sounds like heaven, and it makes me know it's still possible to halt the biodiversity and climate crisis from spiralling out of all control. Well, this book tells you how, in just over 150 highly illustrated, highly readable pages, please can everyone read it. And now, The Last Dragon by Polly Ho-Yen, published by Knights Of. Well, maybe you think children's books already have plenty of dragons and no more are really needed. Well, you're wrong. This fabulous book, The Last Dragon, written by Polly Ho-Yen and illustrated by Karis Loke, is just so, so incredible. It's set in a totally familiar everyday world in Milton Keynes, but there is still one dragon left. It flies around the whole world, causing havoc with fires. But old Tildy, nicknamed that due to being the last dragon, TLD, is a superstar that people love, and they have posters of her on their walls. So our main character, 12-year-old Yara, isn't that obsessed by the dragon herself, but she has an encounter with it that changes everything. I won't give the plot away, but it does involve an egg. And oh wow, the encounter with that dragon is one of the best things I've ever read. But this book isn't really about dragons only. It's about family, especially the power of sister bonds, as Yara's little sister is very seriously ill. It's about friendship and bravery and bullying, being who you are, which is not always how people expect you to be. But it is also about dragons. A real-life dragon in Milton Keynes, and Polly Ho-Yen is some writer. A Home for Stone by Corinne Avaris and Rosalind Beardshaw, published by Hachette. A child finds an adorable, yes, stones can be adorable, stripy stone on the beach and seeks to find the best place for it. Can such a home be found somewhere with other stones like him where he can fit right in? The child finds various great-looking homes with other stones, but the little stone just quivers. It's not right. He ends up being home with different finds, a leaf, a coin, a shell. That suits this stone much better. This stone was up for laughs and new things, not just the same old. It feels like a great book to read to a child who's about to start a new nursery or reception. New situations might be mega fun. The text is in rhyme and the illustrations are so warm and sweet, it adds up to a beautiful picture book. Now I want to tell you about Clarice Bean Smile by Lauren Child. Listeners may know the Clarice Bean picture books, but this is one of the stories about Clarice for older children, best for aged 8 or 9, I'd say, as Clarice is now 11. Clarice is a wonderful, daydreamy girl who has been procrastinating all summer holidays about her school project on endangered things. Now school is back and she has to cram it. And that's not the only problem. It seems like not only the whole world, but a whole family needs her help. So Clarice does what Clarice can, including applying for a job on behalf of her stressed out dad, complete with quotes from her favourite fictional character, Ruby Redfoot. I just love that Ruby Redfoot was once a fictional book series that only existed in Clarice Bean, and then the author, Lauren Child, wrote them in real life. It all adds up to a most charming, funny, engaging caper, which does make a reader smile throughout. And lastly, I want to tell you about Are You a Monster? By Guilherme Carsten, published by Happy Yak. A monster with big, scary yellow eyes, a pointy tail, pointy nails, and also pink spectacles, seeks to discover if you, the reader, are also a monster who might become their scary buddy. Are you or are you not? Can you show your big teeth? Can you make a loud grrr? It's a very interactive book with audience participation so extreme as to drive a bunch of three-year-olds wild. I think it's best not as a bedtime read. It's so clever and it has a hilarious ending. No wonder families and librarians voted this the winning book in BookTrust's Storytime Prize this year.
They all sound great. Emily always makes me feel enthusiastic about what to read next.
Well, I think she's the most officially enthusiastic person about books on the planet.
She's taken
it. Really is.
Like that, hello. That bad bear took the grr. She's taken our enthusiasm.
Yes.
She's using it to save the world.
Yes. Whereas, are you saying that we're jaded already, Frank?
We're jaded. Yeah.
That can't be true.
No,
no, we're not.
True.
Come on. No,
how
we're not.
Anyone be jaded after spending an hour with Rob Biddulph?
I'm going to make you a cup of tea in the posh china.
Okay.
How's about that?
And I'm going to go and milk the posh cow.
Milk the posh cow and then sit in the lazy boy while we say goodbye. Say a big thank you to Rob Biddulph.
And
who else should we say thank you to, Frank?
Well, to the mellifluous Jeff Bird.
course.
And to the even more mellifluous.
You can say it, Frank.
Ukulele. Come on, can
the
I do
ukulele
that?
Of
ukulele of
trio.
Trio.
Trio. We did a listen to the
That's
ukulele
the first
of
time.
Trio.
It took me a year.
Yeah, it took me saying it. And you copying me to say it.
Yeah.
Right. But anyway, we'll get there. We'll get there, listeners, if you're still here. Goodbye, everyone. See you soon.
Goodbye. See you soon.